Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We talk about various aspects of that war in the course of these programs. One of the most important, make no mistake about it, is the home front. And few things are having a greater impact on the state of our security in this war than the dismal condition of our border security and the enforcement of our immigration laws. It's a matter of high controversy, of course. It will be, I'm convinced, a factor in the upcoming midterm elections. And there are a few people who have been engaged, both professionally and in terms of the analysis and monitoring of all of this, than our first guest. He is Judge Andrew Arthur. He has served in the executive branch in a number of capacities, also in the judicial branch and also in the congressional branch. He is a full constitutional authority on the matters that we're going to be talking with him about, namely immigration security. He has, among other things, been an immigration judge in York, Pennsylvania. And I couldn't be more pleased to make his acquaintance. These days, he serves as a resident fellow in law and policy at an organization I think is simply indispensable, the Center for Immigration Studies. Judge Arthur, it is a delight to have you. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Thank you, Frank, and the honor is mine.
There is so much to talk with you about, and I can't begin to do justice to it in this short segment, but I hope that we'll be able to visit with you further in the near future. But in the meantime, in the aftermath of this horrific murder of a young woman by the name of Molly Tibbetts, there is a new impetus behind the effort to rethink what we're doing in the immigration space, border security, interior enforcement, dealing with the challenges that you've adjudicated, of course, in your previous incarnation. Give us your sense of where we are on all of this and the magnitude of the problem that has to be addressed.
Well, there are a number of problems that we're facing right now, Frank, and I think the primary one is the first one in the system, and that is border security. Right now, we have a number of loopholes. The president has attempted to close, Congress has attempted to close, the Republicans in Congress have attempted to close, but have been unsuccessful in doing that, that have been exploited by unaccompanied alien minors, many of whom are on the verge of turning 18, as well as immigrant families who have entered the United States illegally. These individuals exploit these loopholes in order to come to the United States illegally and get released into the public so that they can, you know, live in this country, so that they can enjoy our healthcare system, our education system, so that they can work, which the vast majority of them are coming here to do.
But some are not. Some are coming here to engage in criminal activities. They're all engaged in criminal activities in terms of coming across the border illegally, of course. But beyond that, some are violent, including this individual who's accused of murdering Molly Tibbetts. There are others who are engaged in drug trafficking or human trafficking or perhaps bringing across the border, who knows, weapons of mass destruction or other instruments of terrorism. One of the things that I know Attorney General Jeff Sessions has tried to do in response to all of this is to beef up the presence on the border and the capacity to deal with those coming across it illegally by expanding the number of immigration judges working in this space. Can you discuss for us a little bit, based on your own experience in that capacity, Judge Arthur, the adequacy of that or well, for that matter, how important it is in an overall response to this growing threat?
Having additional immigration judges along the border is absolutely key to getting a handle on the problem. many of the individuals who enter the United States illegally will claim that they have a credible fear of persecution if they get returned to their home countries. The Attorney General has addressed many of those claims in matter of AB to limit the number of claims that are made. But still, about 75 to 90% of all aliens who claim to have a credible fear are found by asylum officers to have one, and they get referred over to immigration judges. The more immigration judges that we have, the more quickly those cases will be heard, and the more likely that those individuals will remain in custody until their claims can be heard. Some claims are good, and we want to make sure that those claims can be heard as quickly as possible so that people can be protected and so that their family members abroad can be brought to the United States. But for the bad claims, and that unfortunately is the vast majority of the ones that we're seeing from the border these days, from the primary sending countries, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico, those individuals need to be returned as quickly as possible to turn off the magnet that's drawing individuals to this country to enter illegally, undermining our border security and undermining our ability to prevent the entry of the contraband that you've talked about, the drugs and the human smuggling that occurs. So it's absolutely key to hire more judges as quickly as possible, get them on the bench, and have them hear in case.
Yeah, and implied in what you said is the fact that oftentimes in the absence of this ability quickly to process these people, they're turned loose and told to come back. And together, that doesn't happen a whole lot. Judge, let me ask you about one other piece of this, which is very much in the news and has been featured prominently, particularly by Democrats critical of the president's efforts to enforce the border laws and capacity to stop this migration. These unaccompanied minors, the role they're playing in sort of incentivizing people to come across the border to deposit their children here, perhaps, or to seek to gain asylum themselves simply because they have these minors already in the country or simply in tow. Talk about the kids, if you would.
Traditionally, throughout the last years of the Obama administration, most families who arrived with children, again, children can be up to the age of 18, those individuals were released, and that incentivized huge numbers of alien minors and families to enter the United States in 2014 and then again in 2016. We're seeing an uptick in that now. This is a huge problem for a couple of reasons. One, every time that a family is apprehended at the border, Border Patrol agents have to be pulled off the line in order to process those families. And that leaves gaps in the lines that are exploited by spotters and smugglers. Two, the trek that those individuals make to the United States through Central America is extremely perilous, and it offers every sort of horror that you could imagine. Individuals are raped, robbed, and killed commonly during that trek to the United States. And in fact, a few years ago, NPR talked about a particular pharmacy in Altar, Sonora, which is on the other side of the border from Arizona, in which women would go to get birth control, anticipating that they would be raped on their way to the United States. These are the horrors that the president is attempting to address, but unfortunately, that have gone unaddressed in the media.
Well, addressing it is one of the things we try to do here at Secure Freedom Radio, Judge Arthur, and I can't thank you enough for taking a little bit of time for our maiden voyage with you. We do look forward to talking with you again very soon. Richard Fisher joins us next. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined, I'm very pleased to say, by Richard Fisher, one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving China's military power, its growth, its implications, and what we best be doing about it. He is a senior fellow on Asian military affairs at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. He's also president of Pacific Strategies Incorporated, the author of numerous books and countless articles. The most recent of his books is China's Military Modernization, Building for Regional and Global Reach. Rick Fisher, welcome back. It is good to have you with us, as always.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be back.
I wanted to get your quick take, Rick, on the latest product of the United States Defense Department in a series that I guess is sort of generically described as the Chinese Military Power Volumes. This assessment has, I think, some new news in it and also is simply further affirmation of what you've been telling us for a long time, is it not?
Frank, since 1999, the Pentagon has been directed by the Congress to produce this report. And it has been welcomed and used and sometimes downplayed and reduced, depending on the president. This year's report, really the first to be owned by the Trump administration, is the longest in the history of these reports since 1999. It's about a third longer, and it is full of interesting additions. In addition to the usual progression of news that it usually covers, this year's report really stands out in one respect, one major respect. It highlights in several sections how China is developing and becoming a globally projected military, how China's People's Liberation Army is starting to play the game of global power projection. And as a consequence, I think as a nation, we can start to conclude, as a government, we can start to conclude that China is not just a regional threat or what we used to call China a peer competitor. China is going to be a global threat to American interests. And as a consequence, it is now necessary to upgrade this report. For a long time, many of us have been advocating that this report be turned into a full-color, illustrated, charted volume like Caspar Weinberger's iconic Soviet military powers.
Yeah, I remember them well.
And now it is time that the China Military Power Report receive the same treatment.
Rick, there's a lot in what you've just said that I want to tease out a little bit. With respect to Chinese ambitions, let's start with that. It's now seemingly accepted, really even on both sides of the political aisle here in the United States, that China seeks to displace the United States as the dominant power in the world. That entails, at least implicitly, a threat to our interests globally, as you say. But what does the report say about the strategic purpose behind this buildup?
It is couched in terms of China going forth to protect its interests. And this is, to a degree, logical. And in this broad sweep of history, this is what large and powerful countries do eventually. Now, what the report does not focus on, however, and what it should focus on is how when China projects, when China goes and builds an economic and political power base, let's say, as it's been doing for the last 20 years in Africa, and just last month culminates in its first Africa-wide defense conference, 49 African countries sending representatives to Beijing for a defense conference. It's not yet an alliance, but by the time China has drawn you into this kind of construct, you have already signed up to a number of things, a number of Chinese priorities. And that's how the Chinese are going to manage global military relationships. It's not so much what you have to do, it's more or less what you can't do. And pretty soon on this list is going to be, you can't have an alliance with the United States. And then you can't be a democratic society. And this is what the Pentagon report does not say. And it very much should say.
Rick, you and I have talked about this for quite some time now, but I'd like to just refresh for our audience. The strategic thrust that this involves, you mentioned Africa, of course, but the Belt and Road Initiative through Asia and Chinese penetration of our own hemisphere and domination of strategic choke points elsewhere around the world, including in the South China Sea and the Caribbean. These are part and parcel, are they not, of this grand design, and at least as worrying as what they're doing on the continent of Africa at the moment?
Indeed, Frank. And the Pentagon report does not speak to such an intense, deliberate global strategy. But for the first time, it begins to outline China's reaching out and how it is beginning to go global. Now, these reports, for all their faults, are actually really the only and the best effort that anybody makes on this earth to define China, its goals, its character, and the threat that it poses, not just to American interests, but to those of our allies as well. And the report is, it's very important to defend this report, but at the same time, to advocate very strongly to make it much better.
Rick, just on this question of the military character of the forces that are now being brought to bear by the Chinese, you've described in your own writings and in our previous conversations improvements in their nuclear forces. Of them, could you just give us a quick assessment of what are some of the most worrying of these improvements that the report is addressing, or even if it's not, that we should be focused on?
For the longest time, the report really has not, in my opinion, told us the real extent of China's nuclear missile capabilities. I believe they're much, much larger than the report tells us. Secondly, China is now on a roll to be building multiple aircraft carriers and the means to protect them around the globe. And at the same time, China is perfecting a series of medium and intermediate range ballistic missiles armed with maneuverable hypersonic warheads that it's going to proliferate across its services. These are going to be launched by ships, from the land, of course, and by aircraft. This is something that we don't have any analog to. We're working on it, but it's going to take us some time. But the investments in high technology, laser, rail guns, the investments in military space capabilities, complemented by their projection, military projection to the moon and beyond, just should concern all of us.
Amen. Rick Fisher, in light of what the Chinese are doing in space and have in mind doing from it, perhaps to us and our vital interests, how critical is it, do you think, that we build the kind of capabilities the president seems to have in mind with this Space Force to exercise not only assured access to and ability to operate in space, but to control that high frontier?
The ability to operate freely in space is probably going to be fundamental to the future of this country and to any other democracy. We are on the cusp of launching into something called the space economy, where resources, manufacturing, activity in space and on the moon and eventually on Mars will become a pillar of the Earth economy. The Chinese certainly want to control that. They want to dominate the moon and the Lagrangian points to be able to determine who will benefit from the future space economy. At a minimum, we need to be able to deny them the ability to take away our future in space. And the president, in forming the Space Force, is in reality, as he has stated, is following what the Chinese and the Russians have already done. They have space forces. So now we're going to have one, and it's about time.
Well, I hope it will be in time. Rick Fisher, we have to leave it at that. So much more to talk with you about, and I hope you'll come back to us for another of our hour-long drill downs on all of this. You are an extraordinary national resource, and I appreciate the time you give us, and I hope we can do a bit more of this in the very near future. In the meantime, Thank you for the work that you are doing at the International Assessment and Strategy Center, and of course at Pacific Strategies, Inc. Folks, once again, please check out Rick's writings, notably China's Military Modernization Building for Regional and Global Reach. Thank you, Rick. We'll talk with you soon. Andrew Arthur joins us from the Center for Immigration Studies next. We'll talk about immigration and more right after this.
Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. One of the highlights of our week is the chance to go inside the ring with Bill Gertz. Of course, that's the title of his prize-winning column at the Washington Times. He's also the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon, an indispensable online resource. He is the author, among other things, of seven best-selling books, including most recently, iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill Gertz, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Good to have you, as always, Bill. And we've been talking with our friend Rick Fisher about the new report out of the Pentagon on Chinese military power. I'd like to get your thoughts on it, and also more broadly, your assessment in particular of something it makes note of, which is the buildup of China's nuclear capabilities.
Yeah, this is very important. This is the annual Pentagon, what we call the China Military Power Report. It came out just a week ago, and it's chock full of new information and details on the Chinese military and their activities. And one of the things that stood out to me in the report was the fact that the Chinese have enhanced their nuclear readiness. And this is something that has not gotten a lot of attention in our media, which is that in addition to all of these high-tech conventional weapons that the Chinese are building, they're really engaged in a massive strategic nuclear forces buildup, the centerpieces of which are a whole range of new missiles, including something called the DF-41, which the report reveals is not only going to be deployed in silos as they have in the past, but will also be on road mobile launchers as well as train rail mobile launchers. Now, this is indicating that once you put these missiles on mobile platforms, they're very difficult to track and identify, and it increases the strategic instability, if you will. I mean, all of our nuclear forces now are kind of sought to balance the Russians, but now the strategic command is going to have to rethink that, and they're going to have to look at how our nuclear forces are going to have to both counter the Russians as well as and now the Chinese.
Bill, in addition to these road mobile and rail mobile platforms for a modern generation of ballistic missiles, the Chinese, of course, have also been deploying an underground system that could, you know, utilize such vehicles, presumably to conceal further these nuclear forces. And yet, with all of this, as I understand it, we are still attributing to the Chinese a relatively small number of nuclear warheads. How could that possibly be?
Yes, the number listed in the latest Pentagon report on China's military power is that the number of missiles is somewhere between 75 and 100. But that number is, I think, way off. And of course, there's been a big debate on this. It's been underway for a number of years. Again, as you mentioned, they have what is known as the Great Underground Wall, which is this tunnel system of 3,000 miles of underground tunnels that are used not just to store their nuclear missiles and warheads, but to actually produce them. They have entire factories underground, spread out all across China. And so this is really a key to understanding the growing Chinese nuclear threat that has to be dealt with. And hopefully, I think the Pentagon is, we're doing a major modernization of our strategic nuclear forces, but they've got to focus more on the Chinese nuclear threat.
Well, we're doing the beginnings of a major nuclear modernization, and it's a question, of course, as to whether that will be completed, and if so, how fast. But Bill, again, I just want to impress upon our listeners, 3,000 miles of tunnel. This would be roughly equivalent to the entire breadth of the United States of America. And the idea that there would only be 75 missiles under there, and perhaps some slightly larger number of warheads, is just implausible in the extreme. And I think it suggests a lowballing of this problem that, as you say, needs to be addressed, especially because, Bill Gertz, you have written today at the Washington Free Beacon about nuclear exercises that the Chinese are now engaging in with the Russians. And it seems pretty clear that the object of those exercises, as it has historically been with respect to the Russians for sure and the Soviets before them, has been attacking us with these nuclear forces. Talk about what we know about these exercises.
Yeah, the piece today in the Free Beacon discusses what is called Vostok 18, and this is a massive strategic exercise, command post exercise. It's going to involve upwards of 150,000 troops, and for the first time, the Chinese are going to take part of this. And the reason the Pentagon is concerned about this is this exercise, held about every 4 years, is the showcase for Russia's new strategic nuclear doctrine of escalate to de-escalate, which is extremely destabilizing because in a regional conflict, the Russians are now saying that they, because of the weakness of their conventional forces, that they're going to use small tactical nuclear weapons right away. And of course, that raises the prospect of a nuclear war, of a regional conflict shifting into a large-scale nuclear war. So they are looking at that, and now they're going to include the Chinese in this exercise. And again, this has raised a lot of concerns within the Pentagon about this joint effort. And it looks like this is the real beginnings of a real military alliance between the Chinese and the Russians, which is something that the U.S. should work very diligently to prevent from happening.
Amen. Well, I tend to think that's partly what President Trump is trying to do with his concerted efforts to romance Vladimir Putin, but it does not seem to be paying much in the way of dividends. Bill, speaking of the Russians, there is, of course, a lot of concern about what they're up to with respect to interfering with our upcoming elections. It's been observed by John Bolton, the National Security Advisor to the President, that it's not just the Russians that are doing that. It is also the Chinese. And, oh, by the way, the North Koreans and the Iranians as well. These sorts of influence operations are part and parcel, of course, of what you have written about in your terrific new book, IWAR. In terms of the role influence operations are now playing in a kind of hybrid warfare against this country, talk about that if you would, and also this point that it's the focus exclusively on the Russians in this regard is simply misplaced.
Yeah, I wrote a piece this week on a hearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which had testimony from the Assistant Secretary of State for Europe. It's a guy named Wes Mitchell, and he really made it really plain that the Russian influence operations are not targeting the GOP. They're targeting the United States, and that the goal is to subvert the United States. And I would argue that the Chinese influence operations are, I would say, orders of magnitude more significant and more dangerous from a national security standpoint than what we've seen from the Russians. And that involves a massive influence campaign to literally buy former U.S. officials, to get them to lobby the U.S. government, to get them to play down or ignore Chinese aggressive behavior, whether it's the takeover of the South China Sea, or its human rights abuses, or its arms sales to countries like Iran and North Korea. And we really need to reestablish a new mechanism which can fight back against this. We need to say, hey, look, we're under information warfare assault. We need to both protect ourselves and defend against it by exposing these operations, as well as engage in counter-influence operations, go on the offensive and take it to both the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, and the Iranians.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Bill. And this is why your book is so important. It really provides a roadmap for the kind of thing that we must be doing to respond appropriately, but also to advance our interests using this important form of 21st century warfare. You know, I'm also struck. You mentioned that it's not just the GOP that they're targeting in all of this. Arguably, all of those four countries have in common that they have been subjected to some pretty punishing sanctions or tariffs or both by the Trump administration. And this is presumably a reason why they would all, if they were involving themselves in our electoral affairs, not just simply seeking to sow division, as you've pointed out, but to help the Democrats. That'd be very interesting to see whether they're as alive to that possibility as they have been to the assertion, as yet unproven, that Donald Trump was one of the principal beneficiaries of Russian interference in the past. Bill, we are out of time. I had wanted to talk to you a bit about clearances and the thrashing that is going on that subject, but that will be for next week, and I look forward to talking with you then. In the meantime, thanks so much for what you do at the Washington Free Beacon, as well as, of course, Inside the Ring, the important column you write, required reading, really, on the affairs of the Defense Department and more at the Washington Times. Check out, again, IWAR, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, come back to us again next week. We'll look forward to it. Next up, David Goldman joins us. We'll talk about one other aspect of China's activities, economic warfare against us, and what's going on with Turkey and more. Straight ahead.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for our weekly visit with David Goldman, one of the preeminent analysts, contributors, observers, critics, and pundits when it comes to matters involving both economics and national security, among other national interests. He is best known, perhaps, for the series of essays he contributes to the Asia Times under his nom de plume, Spengler. He's also the author of a very important book, How Civilizations Die. David Goldman, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Frank, it's an honor and privilege. Thank you.
Privilege is ours. Let me ask you, David, we've been talking with several of our guests about China, and specifically this new report out of the Pentagon that does a fairly good job, not perfect, but fairly good job of documenting the immense, I would even argue, sort of staggering efforts the Chinese are now making to expand their military power and to exercise dominion over much of the planet. The question that I wanted to put to you, as someone who is deeply knowledgeable about China, and particularly about all things economic, is How can they afford to do all of this? They've had a, you know, certainly a booming economy for a long time, but it seems to be not so much at the moment. And is there a danger, as you see it, David, of, kind of imperial overstretch that will prove unsustainable?
There's a danger, but not enough to make me complacent. It could work the other way. China is counting on dual-use technologies having a productivity effect on the civilian economy that will pay for the investment in the military. That's a phenomenon we know very well. We know that the NASA moonshot paid for itself many times over in terms of productivity. And I personally believe that Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative and similar technologies launched a huge productivity wave in the U.S. So in effect, they paid for themselves. Whether that will be true in China remains to be seen, but that is certainly the Chinese objective. China expects to make money out of One Belt, One Road. The idea is that Huawei comes in and builds a national broadband network for you, and then Alibaba and Tencent and Baidu come in and they create an e-finance and e-commerce ecosystem and integrate that economy into China's economy. Whether they'll succeed is a different question, but as an investment banker, I've sat in on Huawei's pitches to major governments, and it could work the other way. They could actually make money out of One Belt and One Road, which frightens me. So I don't think there's any reason for complacency. I don't think we can count on imperial overreach.
No, I get that. And I think you're almost certainly right. That ought to be the basis for planning, at the very least, that they'll be able to carry this off, especially when you add in the strategic value to the Chinese of that kind of digital infrastructure that they will not only integrate into their own economy, but they'll control in these countries that they're seeking to sort of colonize, I guess is the only way to describe it.
It's like the Borg in Star Trek. We will assimilate you. Resistance is futile.
Resistance is futile, indeed. Let me ask you about a related point. As the Chinese are doing this, they are finding, in part, I think you would argue, as a result of Trump administration policies, among those willing to throw in with them, not only the Russians, of course, but even some of our allies in Europe and in Japan. Talk us through that, if you would.
Well, our so-called allies. Well, the first thing the Chinese did after the administration started punitive tariffs was to offer the German and Japanese automobile companies privileged access to the Chinese market. Remember, China is now the biggest auto market in the world. It will continue to grow. They'll probably buy 500 million cars in the next 20 to 25 years.
Buy them, David, rather than build them themselves with technology they've expropriated from those trying to sell them their country?
Well, they are they're called joint ventures, and Volkswagen's been in there for 30 years, giving them the technology. Daimler and BMW are coming in, and Toyota and Nissan just announced massive expansion of their Chinese facilities. So the Chinese market is a huge attraction for foreign automakers and manufacturers, indeed, in many spheres. And the Chinese will basically tell our so-called allies, we'll open the kimono for you, and we will disadvantage American companies. So what I'm told by friends in Berlin and Tokyo in the government is that they're perfectly happy to exploit an opportunity of American-Chinese disagreement to gain market share at American expense. And the Chinese are manipulating them, and they're happy to be manipulated as long as the cash register rings.
Yeah. You know, part of the subtext to this, David, both what you've just described in terms of this sort of colonial expansion, as well as the manipulation of these so-called allies, is, according to Rick Fisher, the insinuation as well of an anti-American demand on the part of the Chinese. As he put it in connection with, for example, this conference that the Chinese held with African defense ministers, that basically part of the deal of having relations with the Chinese will be that you can't have an alliance with the United States. And for that matter, he said, you can't be a democracy. You have to sort of conform to the Chinese way. Do you see that as well?
Well, the Chinese are certainly doing their best to frustrate American policy. An example would be Turkey, where the Chinese have said, gee, You know, now that America's put sanctions on Turkey, they're in financial trouble. That's an opportunity to lock Turkey into one belt, one road, make them dependent on us. That's in the Chinese press. I'm not making it up. Certainly they wish to do that. The Chinese have persuaded little El Salvador to break relations with Taiwan. That's a way of giving us a hot foot close to our border. In general, the Chinese don't care what kind of social system you have as long as they make money out of you and you're going to be part of their sphere. They'll let you have whatever. You want to have elections, they don't care.
Well, it'll be interesting to see whether they do over time or not. But I think the instruments of control that they're pursuing may make that essentially a moot point. Turkey is the thing that I wanted to conclude with you, David Goldman. You follow it closely. Its economy has suffered unquestionably. The value of its currency has declined and the rest. You've warned for some time that the Chinese will try to essentially buy it out, strategic assets especially. Talk also, if you would, David, about what Qatar is up to at the moment, another unfriendly government, it seems to me, as well as sort of the direction that you think Turkey is going to be heading as a result of all of this.
Well, Qatar has always allied with Turkey against Saudi Arabia and the other Sunni powers that the United States is trying to shape into an Arab NATO to contain Iran. So Turkey and Qatar have been Muslim Brotherhood fundamentalists, brothers in arms, and Qatar has also been inviting the Chinese in to train their military. So they've got a lot of Chinese army running around Qatar. It's all the same crowd. It doesn't surprise me. The real risk, of course, is, you know, Qatar is fairly small. They're a gas bubble. They've got a lot of money, but not enough to sustain Turkey by themselves. For China, buying the Turkish stock market would be rounding error in their national wealth fund. And Turkey has a number of things they like. One is all the access to the Mediterranean and to the European market. So Costco, one of the big Chinese companies, already owns the second largest port in Turkey, and the Chinese are talking about buying a lot of other strategic assets. They're investing heavily in some of President Erdogan's white elephant infrastructure projects. They've been investing in the Turkish telecom companies, particularly mobile broadband. So I expect Turkey to come out of this as an economic satrapy of China and a de facto Chinese ally. That's not good for us. And as much as I supported the president's sanctions against Turkey, I think we can't let other countries kidnap American citizens. I don't think the administration thought out all the moves on the chessboard that will arise from their action.
David, just very quickly in concluding, given all of this, what is your view of the advisability of continuing to treat Turkey as a NATO ally if, in fact, it becomes a satrapy of China?
It makes no sense at all. And what I would do is certain things that make the Chinese regret wasting money on Turkey. I don't want to discuss those in public.
All right. Well, we will hope for your counsel offline and await your further analyses in public. David Goldman, again, thank you for the extraordinary contributions you make to our understanding of all these issues. David, come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.